Today is Thursday, June 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Europe's aviation agency urges carriers to avoid Belarusian airspace after the forced landing on May 23rd of a Ryanair jet.
EU leaders denounce the move as a hijacking and an act of piracy.
Plus, it's taken 2 years, but Israel has a new government.
35 minutes before the midnight deadline, he has succeeded in forming a government of 8 parties.
And spam. We'll have these stories and more next. The European Union Aviation Safety Agency has beefed up its stance on the use of Belarusian airspace, calling on regional authorities to bar their airlines from flying over the country. Associated Press correspondent Charles Deledesma starts us off.
ESA, based in Cologne, Germany, has issued a safety information bulletin advising operators to avoid the airspace of Belarus following the May 23 incident in which Belarusian flight controllers told the crew of a Ryanair plane en route from Greece to Lithuania to land there. EU leaders denounced the move as a hijacking and an act of piracy, responding by barring Belarusian carriers from the bloc's airspace and sketching out tougher sanctions. I'm Charles Deledesma.
It went down to the wire on Wednesday, but Israel has a new government after 2 years and 4 elections. The new governing coalition effectively ends Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's 12 years in office. Reporter Ricky Rosen gave me the details from Jerusalem.
Yair Lapid, the head of the Yesh Atid party, who was granted the opportunity to form a government by the president, called the president Rivlin, who was in the middle of a National Cup soccer game, to inform him that 35 minutes before the midnight deadline, he had succeeded in forming a government of 8 parties, ranging from hardline far left to far right, and including an Israeli Arab party for the first time in Israeli history. And it's a party of strange bedfellows, because on many, many issues, they have admitted that they will never be in agreement, but they're hoping that they will be able to somehow bridge the divides in Israeli society that have been exacerbated by 12 years of a very divisive Netanyahu government.
Ricky, as you mentioned, this government formed with just 35 minutes to spare, and if it hadn't done so, there was a potential for a fifth election. Why did it take so long to come together just before that midnight deadline?
Everyone was trying until the very last minute to get the best deal for their party. The last conflicts to be resolved were between the hardline right-wing party, Yamina, the party of the upcoming prime minister, Naftali Bennett, and the leftist Labour Party, over who would sit on the committee which chooses judges, a very significant committee, a little like the role the Republicans in the U.S. Congress played in pushing through conservative federal and Supreme Court judges. And they finally decided after a few days of negotiating that they would have a rotating place on this committee. And the other last-minute concessions involved the Islamic Arab Party, which was able to get $16 billion in benefits for the Arab sector, something which had never been officially included in a government platform before.
So what's next? Because the government is set to be sworn in sometime within the next 10 days. And I guess also, what's next in store for current prime minister, who's on his way out, Benjamin Netanyahu?
When you say that the new government should be sworn in between 7 and 10 days from now, that is a best case scenario, because the government is based on the very slimmest majority possible, 61 votes out of 120. So it can be easily brought down by any defector. And Benjamin Netanyahu has pledged to try to get any one member of any of the conflicting parties to defect from this coalition. And he may have a chance to be able to do this before the government is sworn in next week, or certainly after, because, as I said, it's a very vulnerable government of very widely opposing and a wide range of opposing views. And Netanyahu is not resigning as head of his party, as is customary when a party loses power in an election. But he has pledged to work as the head of the opposition and to try to topple this new government. In the meantime, being out of power, he's going to have to deal with the three corruption charges for which he's already been indicted and is standing trial.
Ricky, this isn't the only electoral news coming out of Israel on Wednesday. Parliament elected a new president. What can you tell us about Isaac Herzog?
Well, it's interesting because coincidentally, on the same day as this extremely narrow and divided government is being formed, tentatively, the president, Isaac Herzog, he was chosen by the biggest consensus ever, 87 votes out of 120, because he is a mild-mannered, non-controversial, very agreeable kind of man who served as head of the Labour Party, served as head of the Jewish Agency, which deals with Jews from around the world, and was able to get the support of the widest margin of politicians in the Knesset, because he has promised to build bridges within Israeli society.
From Jerusalem, that was reporter Ricky Rosen. UNRWA, the United Nations agency that deals with Palestinian refugees, says that it has recalled its Gaza director after complaints it received following an interview on Israeli television. Several Palestinians were angered by statements made by Matthias Schmeil, where he did not dispute Israel's characterization of its airstrikes as being precise. More than 250 Palestinians died in the 11 days of conflict that began on May 11th. Schmeil did apologize on May 25th, saying, quote, "There is no justification whatsoever for the killing of civilians," end quote. He also added, quote, "Military precision and sophistication are never a justification for war," end quote. Iran's largest naval vessel sank on Wednesday in the Gulf of Oman. Reuters' Lauren Anthony has the details.
Iran's biggest Navy warship sank on Wednesday. The country's highest tonnage Navy vessel, known as the Karg, caught fire in the Gulf of Oman near the port of Jask, where it was on a training mission. All of its crew members disembarked safely following rescue operations that went on for hours. But efforts to save the ship itself were unsuccessful and it sank, according to Fars News Agency. No further explanation has been given for the latest incident in the region of sensitive waterways, though there have been accusations of attacks on ships owned by archenemies Iran and Israel there in the past. Iran has refused to recognize Israel since the Islamic Revolution in 1979 that toppled the US-backed Shah. And Israel sees Iran's nuclear program as a threat to its existence. Both parties have claimed they were targeted by the other in the last few months.
Lord Anthony of Reuters. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. The UN Refugee Agency is warning of a severe shortage of COVID-19 vaccines in the Asia-Pacific region. That's putting the lives of refugees and asylum seekers at risk as this deadly disease continues to spread like wildfire. Lisa Schlein has that story.
Countries in the Asia-Pacific region host most of the world's 80 million forcibly displaced people. These countries have pledged to include refugees and asylum seekers into their COVID-19 vaccination programs. However, there are not enough vaccines to go around, so marginalized groups are among the last to benefit from these schemes. In the past 2 months, the World Health Organization has recorded some 38 million COVID-19 cases and more than 500,000 deaths in the the Asia-Pacific region, the largest increase globally. The UN Refugee Agency reports refugees who live in overcrowded, unsanitary settings are especially vulnerable to the spread of COVID-19. UNHCR spokesman Andrei Mihecic says there has been a huge increase in the number of cases among Rohingya refugees in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, since April. He notes nearly 900,000 refugees are living in this densely populated camp, the largest in the world.
As of 31 May, there have been over 1,188 cases confirmed among the refugee population, with more than half of these cases recorded in May alone. We have also seen a worrying increase in the number of COVID-19 cases among refugees and asylum seekers in Nepal, Iran, Pakistan, Thailand, Malaysia, and Indonesia.
Even as much of the world appears to be recovering from the pandemic, aid agencies report fragile health systems in many countries in the region are struggling to cope with the recent surge of cases. They say help is needed to address the scarcity of hospital beds, oxygen supplies, and other essential health facilities and services. Mihecic says efforts are underway to mitigate the spread of the virus, but preventive measures must be bolstered with intensified vaccinations. He says some refugees, including in Nepal, have received their first vaccine dose with supplies provided by WHO's COVAX vaccination sharing facility.
Among the Rohingya refugees in camps in Bangladesh, not a single vaccine has been administered yet, given the scarcity of supplies in the country. The current delays in vaccine shipments brought about by limited supplies to COVAX mean that some of the world's most vulnerable people remain susceptible to the virus.
The UNHCR is appealing for equitable access to COVID-19 vaccines to save lives and curb the devastating impact of the virus in the Asia-Pacific region. It is urging the wealthier countries to donate surplus doses to COVAX for distribution in the poorer countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This week, Israel's health ministry announced a potential link to myocarditis, or heart inflammation, young men after receiving the second Pfizer coronavirus vaccine dose. Between December of last year and May of 2021, 275 cases were detected following the administration of over 5 million doses. In a statement, Pfizer said that it was aware of the Israeli findings, but that no causal links had been found and that it was meeting regularly with Israel's vaccine safety department. Last month, a U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention group recommended additional studies of messenger RNA coronavirus vaccines to investigate any potential links between myocarditis and either the Pfizer or Moderna vaccines. Of all the cases in Israel, 95 were deemed mild. In the United States, President Joe Biden says the nation needs to pull out all the stops to get more people vaccinated in the coming weeks as he looks toward a self-imposed July 4th deadline. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
The president says the nation's moving toward an all-American summer.
A summer of joy, a summer of get-togethers and celebrations.
But it first needs to pull out all the stops to meet his goal of having 70% of adults partially vaccinated by July 4th. He says public and private partnerships will keep finding ways of getting more people vaccinated.
With incentives and fun rewards.
Ranging from free sports tickets to free drinks. Anheuser-Busch says it'll buy Americans 21 and over a round of beers if the president's goal is met.
That's right. Get a shot and have a beer.
63% of adults have now received at least one vaccine dose. Sagar Magani, Washington.
As the United States nears roughly the midway point of its withdrawal from Afghanistan, a question that remains is if neighboring Pakistan will host U.S. forces in the region to enable them to provide over-the-horizon support. In the past, Pakistan has rejected that notion. Dr. Esfandiar Mir is an expert on terrorism in Afghanistan and Pakistan at the University of California at Berkeley. He tells VOA Afghan service reporter Amadoula Archiwal, agreeing to a hosting request isn't entirely outside the realm of possibility.
So this is a very complicated issue for Pakistan. And my sense is that Pakistani policymakers, specifically army generals, senior army generals, they're going to weigh this proposition very carefully. On the one hand, they will be concerned about the potential of any backlash, domestic political backlash. They will also worry about how groups like the Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan might use basing for purposes of recruitment and propaganda. But on the other hand, Pakistani policymakers will also consider the potential gains of this type of basing. So what we know is that Pakistan's economy is not doing well. Pakistan is also under the threat of sanctions. Pakistan is also worried about India's growing alignment with the United States. Military basing which anchors U.S.-Pakistan strategic relationship for a period of time, it's possible that Pakistani policymakers see that as a gain worth having. And let's not forget the history of U.S.-Pakistan basing relationship. In the 60s, the U.S. had a base in Pakistan near Peshawar called Padabeer. Then in the 1980s, the U.S. Had multiple bases in Pakistan for the war in Afghanistan to support the Mujahideen. And then even in the 1990s, U.S. and Pakistan worked on a secret basing arrangement or secret covert action arrangement to kill Osama bin Laden, which was supported by the 1999 military coup of General Musharraf. And finally, post 9/11, U.S. had multiple bases in Pakistan from which it waged the war on terrorism. So there's ample history of this type of basing, and for now, I would not rule it out. I think it is still within the realm of possibility, but clearly there will be major downsides of this decision if Pakistan goes this path.
Yeah, so we will talk about its consequences, Pakistan and for the region. But the question is, if Pakistan provides access to the U.S. or provides bases to the U.S., how effective would be these bases in reining in terrorists, not only in Afghanistan, but also in the region?
So we have to look at how U.S. has waged some of these campaigns in places like Yemen, Somalia, and in northwest Syria over the last decade or so. There, the United States government has not tried to destroy the entire terrorist organization that it is worried about. Instead, it has only killed the top leadership of the terror group that they are worried about, and people who are engaged in plotting against Europe and the United States. So I expect that any basing in Pakistan will be used to, one, monitor the threat of any transnational jihadist activity inside Afghanistan. Most likely, it will be Al Qaeda, and beyond that, the U.S. government will seek to monitor plotting activity that might take place, a flow of funds, flows of any Western foreign fighters, especially, so against such a limited target set, it's possible that this type of campaigning can be successful. We see in Syria the organization of Al Qaeda there, Khurasuddin, it has been badly damaged by U.S. targeting over the last 3 to 4 years. Even in Yemen, we see that some people in Al Qaeda who were involved in plotting against the United States, they have been set back. Their operations have been largely curtailed by U.S. counterterrorism pressure. So it's possible that in this case, any future threat that might emerge, it can be brought below a certain level. But we have to also consider the reality that the Afghan Taliban will be, can potentially be the state in Afghanistan, and the Afghan Taliban can be potentially supportive to some of these organizations, which means that some of these groups might have better means to both hide and to recover in case of losses.
That was UC Berkeley's Esfandiar Mir speaking to the VOA Afghan Services, Amadoula Archiwal. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A massive and long-awaited new translation of Mein Kampf, peppered with scholarly commentary to explain Nazi leader Adolf Hitler's disjointed hate-filled manifesto has been released in France. The project has been controversial, but supporters say it could serve as a warning against rising acts of hate and anti-Semitism today. Lisa Bryant has that story.
It's 1,000 pages and costs more than $120. Adolf Hitler's name and face do not appear on its plain white cover. This is the recast translation of Mein Kampf, or My Struggle, Hitler's 1925 manifesto, detailing how he became anti-Semitic, his ideology, and his plans for Germany. The new edition by French publisher Fayard, titled Putting Evil in Context, a critical edition of Mein Kampf, does not aim to be a bestseller. French bookstores cannot stock copies, which are available by order only. All proceeds will go to the Auschwitz-Birkenau Foundation. So why publish it? Historian Christian Ingrao, part of the academic team involved in the Fayard edition, told French radio it aimed to desacralize Hitler's work that has attracted a kind of fetishism. It aims to offer an unvarnished take on the Nazi leader's writing, which he and others say is repetitive, rambling, and riddled with mistakes. Some say it was written like a pig, in Grau said, so it was important to use pig-like French to reflect that. Translator Olivier Manoni himself called Hitler's manifesto an incoherent soup. The translation is accompanied by lengthy historians' notes and annotations that make up most of the book. Germany and Poland have published similar scholarly translations in recent years. Here in France, the first French edition of Mein Kampf came out in 1934 and attempted to improve on Hitler's writing. By that time, he was Chancellor of Germany, where his book had become a bestseller. Hitler's rule saw Europe plunged into World War II and the Holocaust that killed roughly 6 million Jews, including more than 70,000 from France. Today, anti-Semitism is again on the rise across Europe, watchdog groups say. So is the far right. While printed copies of Mein Kampf have stagnated worldwide, digital editions have surged in recent years, although publishers point to a mix of reasons. Last year, Amazon banned most editions of the book from its site. 96-year-old Holocaust survivor Ginette Kolinka speaks to French school groups about her memories. She told French radio she had never read Mein Kampf, mostly, she says, because she had other books to read. But she says young people need to read everything, good and bad, to form opinions for themselves and eventually understand tolerance. The Fayard translation project has been controversial. A few years ago, far-left leader Jean-Luc Mélenchon called it morally unacceptable. Since then, it has been endorsed by several prominent Jewish figures, including Nazi hunter Serge Klarsfeld.
C'est de dire, on ne peut pas à la fois reprocher au monde.
And France's Grand Rabbi, Chaim Corsia, who told VOA Klarsfeld's support for the translation shaped his own views. His argument, you can't reproach the world for not having read Hitler's writings nearly a century ago, which forecast the horror the Nazi leader was preparing, and then tell people today not to read this new translation, which could help prevent hatred, prejudice, and anti-Semitism from reappearing. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The discovery of the remains of more than 200 children at a former residential school has sparked outrage in Canada. Reuters' Olivia Chan has the details.
The discovery of a mass grave for 215 children in Canada last week at a former school for Indigenous children is prompting calls for a nationwide search at other similar institutions for more burials. Indigenous groups in Canada are leading the calls in an episode that has shocked the country. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says a search would be, quote, an important part of discovering the truth, but did not make specific commitments. Grand Chief Stuart Phillip, the president of the Union of British Columbia Indian Chiefs, said the Indigenous communities are working to figure out how to investigate. The discovery was first announced by the Tequamlus Tessequapum First Nation.
prompting some people to lay hundreds of tiny shoes and flowers in public squares and in front of the Kamloops Indian Residential School, where some as young as 3 years old were buried. Between 1831 and 1996, Canada's residential school system forcibly separated children from their families. Children were subject to abuse, malnutrition, and rape. A commission tasked with investigating the system called it cultural genocide in 2015. The fourth volume of the commission's report identified 3,200 children who died at residential schools, about a third of whom were not named. 900 more children have been identified since the report's publication 6 years ago.
Olivia Chan reports for Reuters News. And finally, before spam became a computer term, it was an American luncheon meat that was exported and embraced by cultures around the world, especially Asians. Spam musubi in Hawaii and budae-jjigae in South Korea come to mind as some of the dishes that I have personally sampled in my travels around the globe. Currently, spam is sold in more than 40 countries worldwide, and immigrants in the U.S. are serving it, but with a twist. VOA's Elizabeth Lee went on a spam culinary tour in Los Angeles.
In almost every Asian pantry, you'll find a can of spam. This cooked pork product in a can has become one of America's most notable exports, especially to Asia, where pork is the centerpiece of many regional cuisines.
I thought spam is Korean-made product when I was very young.
Spam's largest market outside of the U.S. is Korea, where it was a staple in Timothy Hong's lunchbox as a child. Now he makes the Korean dish army stew at home in Los Angeles. He recalls how his grandfather brought spam to his family during the Korean War.
He used to work with the United States Army, and he got some, you know, lots of spam.
The global impact of this luncheon meat started during the Second World War, when the U.S. shipped more than 45 million kilograms of spam abroad to feed Allied troops.
It was, you know, vacuum sealed in that can. That's how it expanded around the world to our Allied forces. The American GIs, who then shared it with the local communities.
Since then, cultures worldwide, especially those in Asia, have embraced spam and made it their own. More than 80 years after its creation, spam's popularity is still growing.
2020 was the sixth consecutive year where spam saw record sales in the U.S., and immigrants from Asia and the Pacific Islands are helping with the popularity of spam in the U.S. market.
This Hawaiian cafe in Los Angeles started with two spam dishes, but customers kept asking for more. Now owner Paul Waba has 14 different ways of cooking spam.
We started up by just going to a local store, just give me like five cans a week. Now I get growing and growing to the point where I can't fit them in my car no more. So I go through 100 cases a month of spam.
That's 2,400 cans of spam. Customers can even find spam burritos and tacos.
So we get a lot of Hispanic people here who likes that.
In Cambodia Town near Los Angeles, Teddy Deep created a popular protein-packed non-traditional Vietnamese sandwich with eggs and spam.
Nobody incorporated pickled carrot and daikon in the spam. The sweetness and the saltiness combined together to make a different taste.
As foodies' palates evolve, so has luncheon meat. Hormel Foods now has 11 varieties of spam. The company Omni Foods created a plant-based luncheon meat called Omni Pork, served at Chef John Liu's Los Angeles-based Chinese Peruvian restaurant, Chifa.
It's already pre-cut, and you cook it. It has to stay frozen. But other than that, the taste is very comparable.
Liu's and his wife's parents from Taiwan and Hong Kong introduced them to spam.
Other parts of my family are vegan, so clearly now they get to enjoy this, where they before they were not eating meats.
Spam and other luncheon meat brands will continue to evolve as immigrants from Asia and the Pacific Islands try new and creative ways of cooking spam and reintroducing it to the U.S. with its salad bowl of immigrant cultures. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.